Two selections for this evening. The first one's out of Meditations 4 by Ajahn and Jeff, page 83. It's entitled The Skill of Restraint. People often ask how to bring the practice into daily life. The answer is relatively simple. It's one many people don't like to hear, but it is simple. Restraint. There are basically two kinds of restraint. There's restraint in what you do and restraint in how you look and listen, and smell, and taste, and feel, and think about things. In other words, restraint in what goes out and what goes in. And both kinds of restraint require a good amount of skill. Take restraint of the senses. There's a skill to looking, a skill to listening. You want to look at things in such a way that you're not exciting greed, anger, and delusion. You want to listen to things in such a way that you don't excite greed, anger, or delusion, and so on down the line through the senses. This is a skill. You want to be able to do it in such a way that you don't starve yourself of pleasures to the point where you break down and suddenly find yourself in front of an open refrigerator scarfing down a gallon of ice cream. You need to know how to keep the mind well-fed even as you're starving the defilements. In mastering this skill, it helps to have concentration as a foundation. The texts often give restraint of the senses as a prerequisite for concentration, but as so often the case in the Buddha's teaching, the two qualities actually help each other along. Try to notice when you look at something. Does your attention go flowing out? Do you lose your sense of the body? If you do, it's a sign that your looking isn't all that skillful. You want to be able to stay in the body as you look, as you listen, to maintain your sense of breath energy throughout the body. If you can't, that's a sign either that you're looking for the purpose of forgetting the body, in other words, you're looking for the purpose of greed, anger, or delusion, or you're simply careless, and the sight, the sound, the smell, or the taste, whatever, happen to catch you off guard. That's how most people look and listen and smell and taste and feel and think about things. They forget their inner center and suddenly find themselves centered outside, trying to get some pleasure from grabbing onto a sight or a sound and then elaborating on it, either to make it more attractive or to make it seem more meaningful than it actually is. If the mind is in a mood for a little bit of anger, you focus on the things that would provoke the anger and then you can elaborate on it, proliferate as much as you like. Those are where our skills tend to be. We're great at proliferating. But if you think of input of the senses as a kind of food for the mind, which is how the Buddha sees it, you have to ask yourself, are you preparing good food for the mind or junk food or poisonous food? That's the kind of cooking we're used to. We think we're cooking up great meals, but they can make us sick. So you've got to learn a new way to cook for the mind. The Buddha counts sensory input among the four foods for consciousness. It actually includes three of the four: contact at the senses, intention at the senses, why you're looking at these things, listening to these things to begin with, and then consciousness of the act of sensing. These three aspects of sensory input are what the mind is feeding on all the time. The basic skill in learning new ways to cook this food is to focus on the breath and get the mind centered inside. You're actually changing the level of the mind when it's inside the body in this way. Instead of being on the sensual level, it's suddenly on the level of form, which is a higher level than the level of sensual desire. Even though there may be the desire to stay here at the level of form, it's a skillful desire because it raises the level of the mind. You're not so dependent on things outside for your happiness, so you're in a position where you can look at sensual pleasures from above. At the same time, you're learning how to make the most of what you've already got. As Ajahn Lee says, it's like learning how to grow food on your own property rather than invading the property of others to plant crops on their land. Learn how to develop a sense of ease, a sense of fullness and refreshment right here in the body. Make that your food. Try to preserve and protect that level of the mind. That's the skill in how you look at things and listen to things. Maintaining this sense of the center in the body, a sense of ease, refreshment, and fullness no matter what happens outside. That puts the mind on a higher plane and in a much better position. When you handle restraint of the senses in this way, you're not depriving the mind. You're simply learning how to give the mind better food, to nourish it in a healthier way, a way that's totally blameless. Sometimes you hear people talking about the dangers of getting attached to jhana, as if it were a huge monster waiting to ambush you on the side of the path. But the dangers of jhana are relatively minor. The dangers of being stuck on the sensual level, though, are huge. When your happiness is dependent on sensory pleasures being a certain way, it can lead to all sorts of unskillful behavior as you try to keep on feeding the mind the kind of sights, sounds, etc. that it likes. This is why you see so much killing and stealing, illicit sex, lying, getting drunk around us in the world. All the precepts get broken because of people's attachments to the pleasures of the senses. You don't see anybody killing or stealing because of their attachment to jhana. So even though this is an attachment, it's a better one. And when your happiness is not dependent on things outside being a certain way, people outside have less power over you. We see this so much these days. All they have to do is wave the red flag. Quote, there's danger out there. There are terrorists out there. They can harm us. We've got to do all kinds of evil things to stop them. That's what they tell us. If your mind's only nourishment is things outside, you're going to be swayed by those arguments. But when you can step back and say, no, I've got a source of pleasure, a source of happiness inside that people outside can't touch, then you're much less likely to be led astray. In this way, your ability to find nourishment inside is protection for the mind. The pleasures of the world outside hold a lot less poison because you're not trying to feed on them anymore. They're still there, but you can learn how to handle them more skillfully, use them more skillfully, as you try to make the mind even stronger. For instance, there will be times in your meditation when things aren't going as well as you'd like. In cases like that, it can be helpful to go outside and look at the beauty of nature around you, the clouds, the sunset, the moon, and the stars at night, to help clear and refresh your mind. There are passages in the canon where Mahakasapa, who is one of the strictest and sternest of the Buddha's disciples, talks about the beauty of nature. The constant refrain in his verses of how the hills, the mountains, bathed in rain, and the jungle refresh him. Some of the first wilderness poetry in the world is in the Pali Canon. An appreciation of the beauties is not just of nature, but of wild nature. The sort of appreciation is a part of the skill in learning how to gladden the mind. What this comes down to is that, as the Buddha said, even something as simple as looking or listening can be developed as a skill. You look and listen while at the same time trying to maintain your sense of being centered inside. This is one of the best measurements for how much greed, anger, or delusion is lurking in the mind and pushing it around. If you catch the mind flowing out to a particular object, there you are. You have found a defilement. Many of us in the West don't like the word defilement. We deny that there's anything defiled in our minds. And yet, when the mind is clouded by desire, narrowed by desire, that's precisely what the Buddha means. Your sense of inner awareness gets obscured and narrowed as your attention goes flowing out. According to Ajahn Lee, the tendency to flow out to things is the meaning of asava, effluent, or fermentation. That kind of looking and listening, the kind where your mind flows out to the object, is unskillful looking, unskillful listening. If you're skillful, you can stay inside while you see and hear. When you catch the mind in the course of flowing out, you've learned an important lesson, that there's still greed, anger, and delusion in the mind. If you want to look for it, here it is. Only when you see it can you actually do something about it. You begin to sense the danger of falling for those currents. You develop the motivation to want to do something about it, so that you don't have to get pushed around like this anymore. You find out ways to stopping the flow at its source. This is where you find that being inside the form of the body really is a higher level of food for the mind, a higher level of happiness, a better place to be. You want to do everything you can to stay here, regardless of what happens outside. When a wildfire swoops down the mountainside at you, you want to stay right here where you are. You may want to move the body, of course, but you want to stay centered right inside the body. When those disappointments come in life, you still want to stay here and not let the disappointments from outside the mind make inroads into the mind. When a cold wave comes, a heat wave comes, you want to be able to find your refreshment, your sense of well-being here in the body. This is why restraint of the senses is not deprivation. It's actually a way of feeding the mind better food, giving it a higher level of pleasure. But you can't have everything. If you go for more dangerous food, you miss out on the better food. You've got to make the choice, health food or junk food. In that sense, restraint is a form of deprivation, but it's actually a trade. You're getting something better in return. As you go through the day, keep asking yourself that question, what am I feeding on right now? And what is it saying about the mind? What am I learning about the mind by watching the way I feed? In this way, the simple act of looking or listening is a part of the practice. If you do it skillfully, it's nourishment for the practice. It keeps it going. The path doesn't provide refreshment for the mind only while you sit here with your eyes closed or while you're doing walking meditation. When you know how to exercise restraint, you can gain refreshment throughout the day. There's a continuity in the practice. When you sit down and close your eyes, you're right here. You don't have to spend the whole hour pulling the mind in like a cat on a leash because it's already here. You've already been developing the wisdom and discernment that protect the mind, keeping it here. You don't have to cook them up fresh every time you sit down and meditate. So think of everything you do throughout the day as a skill, including the way you exercise restraint. Sometimes that means not looking at or listening to things you don't know how to deal with yet, like a beginning boxer who knows enough not to take on a world champion. But you won't have to go through life with blinders on all the time. You can teach yourself how to look at things the way, look at things that used to set you off your anger or set off your lust, but you do it in a way that doesn't set you off. If there's something you feel greed for, look at the unattractive side of getting. What would it be involved in trying to gain that thing and keep it? If there is lust, think of the unattractive side of the human body, your own, that of everyone else around you. As Ajahn Lee would say, look at things with both eyes, not just one. And furthermore, stay centered right here while you're doing your looking so that you can check and see if you're looking and listening, you're really staying separate from the defilement. Or are you sneaking it in? Or are you flowing along with it? This is why restraint is a good check on the mind in two senses of the word check. Not only to stop it, but also to keep tabs on what's actually going on. If there's defilements, if the defilements seem really quiet while you sit in meditation, well, here's your chance to test them. Do they flow out during the rest of the day? Restraint is what provides continuity to the practice. If you do it skillfully, your looking and listening all become part of the practice. They can keep you on the path all day long. In this second reading is from The Paradox of Becoming, starting on page 32, and it's continuing with the theme of nutriment. The four nutriments of consciousness are simply versions of kama, path, past, and present. When there is passion, delight, this is a quote now from Samyutta Nikaya 1264, quote, when there is passion, delight, and craving for the nutriment of physical food, consciousness lands there and increases. Where there is passion, delight, and craving for the nutriment of contact, consciousness lands there and increases. Where there is passion, delight, and craving for intellectual intention, consciousness lands there and increases. Where there is passion, delight, and craving for consciousness, consciousness lands there and increases. Physical food becomes available through kama, past and present. Contact is listed twice in the description of dependent co-arising, once as a subfactor under name and form, and once as the intermediate link between the six senses and feeling. In the latter location, contact obviously means sensory contact. In the former, its meaning is less obvious, but apparently means contact among the various mental events and physical properties that make up name and form. Although the standard description of dependent co-arising lists name and form as dependent on consciousness, in which case consciousness would serve as food for contact, Other versions of dependent co-arising list name and form and consciousness side by side as mutually supporting. Thus, contact, in this context, apparently means contact among mental events and the physical properties. Because these events and properties are shaped by kama, contact is shaped by kama as well. Because kama is defined as intention, the nutriment of intellectual intention, which is one of the other nutriments, is simply mental kama in the present. Consciousness is listed as the fourth nutriment for consciousness because, as we have already seen, consciousness appears twice in the standard list of dependent co-arising, allowing for the first occurrence of consciousness to act as food for the second. Consciousness, in the role of nutriment, apparently corresponds to the consciousness aggregate, which would explain why many discourses discuss all five aggregates and not just the first four as grounds for becoming. Some passages in the canon actually depict all four forms of nutriment as grounds for becoming, thus supporting the interpretation that they are essentially kama with another name. This quote is from Sanyutta Nikaya 1264. Where there is passion, delight, and craving for the nutriment of physical food, consciousness lands there and increases. Where consciousness lands and increases, there is the alighting of name and form. Where there is the alighting of name and form, there is the growth of fabrications. Where there is the growth of fabrications, there is the production of renewed becoming in the future. Where there is the production of renewed becoming in the future, there is future birth, aging, and death, together, I tell you, with sorrow, affliction, and despair. Similarly, for the nutriments of contact, intellectual intention, and consciousness. So, the introduction of kama as nutriment in the second field analogy adds nothing substantial to the first. What it does add is the emphasis on an important aspect of conditionality as a whole, which is that causal dependency is best seen as an act of feeding. The Buddha underscores this point with his most fundamental teaching on the topic and the novice's questions. He introduces the theme of conditionality in the very first question under the image of feeding. And this is from the fourth. The novice's questions, quote, what is the one? All beings subsist on nutriment. Unlike later schools of Buddhism, which illustrate causal dependence with the image of light reflecting from jewels and mirrors, suggesting an innocent, dazzling beauty, beautiful process, the Buddha uses the image of feeding to portray causal dependence in a much more disturbing way, so as to induce dispassion for it. So the next here is a lengthy sutta from Samyutta Nikaya 1263. I think the title is, it doesn't have here, I think it's the sun. Quote, and how is physical food to be regarded? Suppose a couple, a husband and wife, taking meager provisions, were to travel through a desert with them with their only baby son, dear and appealing. Then the meager provisions of the couple going through the desert would be used up and depleted, while there was still a stretch of desert yet to be crossed. The thought would occur to them, our meager provisions are used up and depleted, while there's still a stretch of the desert yet to be crossed. What if we were to kill this only baby son of ours, dear and appealing, and make dried meat and jerky? That way, chewing on the flesh of our son, at least the two of us would make it through this desert. Otherwise, all three of us would perish. So they would kill their only baby son, dear and appealing, and make dried meat and jerky. Chewing on the flesh of their son, they would make it through the desert. While eating the flesh of their only son, they would beat their breasts, crying, where have you gone, our baby son? Where have you gone, our only baby son? Now what do you think, bhikkhus? Would that couple eat that food playfully or for intoxication or for putting on bulk or for beautification? No, Lord. Wouldn't they eat that food simply for the sake of making it through the desert? Yes, Lord. In the same way I tell you, is that nutriment of physical food is to be regarded. When physical food is comprehended, passion for the five strings of sensuality is comprehended. When passion for the five strings of sensuality is comprehended, there is no fetter bound by which a disciple of the noble ones would come back again to this world. And how is the nutriment of contact to be regarded? Suppose a flayed cow were to stand leaning against a wall. The creatures living in the wall would chew on it. If it were to stand leaning against a tree, The creatures living in the tree would chew on it. If it were to stand exposed to the water, the creatures living in the water would chew on it. If it were to stand exposed to the air, the creatures living in the air would chew on it. For wherever the flayed cow were to stand exposed, the creatures living there would chew on it. In the same way, I tell you, is the nutriment of contact to be regarded. When the nutriment of contact is comprehended, the three feelings, pleasure, pain, neither pleasure nor pain are comprehended. When the three feelings are comprehended, I tell you, there is nothing further for a disciple of the noble ones to do. And how is the nutriment of intellectual intention to be regarded? Suppose there were a pit of glowing embers, deeper than a man's height, full of embers that were neither flaming nor smoking, and a man were to come along, loving life, hating death, loving pleasure, abhorring pain, and two strong men, having grabbed him by the arms, were to drag him to the pit of embers. To get far away would be the man's intention. Far away would be his wish. Far away would be his aspiration. Why is that? Because he would realize, if I fall into this pit of glowing embers, I will meet with death from that cause, or with death-like pain. So the same way, I tell you, is the nutriment of intellectual intention to be regarded. When the nutriment of intellectual intention is comprehended, the three forms of craving for sensuality, for becoming, and for non-becoming are comprehended. When the three forms of craving are comprehended, I tell you, there is nothing further for a disciple of the noble ones to do. And how is the nutriment of consciousness to be regarded? Suppose that having arrested a thief, a criminal, they were to show him to the king, quote, "This is a thief and a criminal for you, your majesty. Impose on him whatever punishment you like." So the king would say, "Go, men, and stab him in the morning with 100 spears. So they would stab him in the morning with 100 spears. Then the king would say at noon, "Men, how is that man?" "Still alive, your majesty." So the king would say, "Go, men, and stab him at noon with 100 spears. So they would stab him at noon with 100 spears. Then the king would say in the evening, "Men, how is that man?" "Still alive, your majesty." So the king would say, "Go, men, and stab him in the evening with 100 spears. So they would stab him in the evening with 100 spears. Now what do you think, bhikkhus? Would that man, being stabbed with 300 spears a day, experience pain and distress from that cause? Even if he were stabbed with only 1 spear, Lord, he would experience pain and distress from that cause, to say nothing of 300 spears. In the same way, I tell you, monks, is the nutriment of consciousness to be regarded. When the nutriment of consciousness is comprehended, name and form are comprehended. When name and form are comprehended, I tell you, there is nothing further for a disciple of the noble ones to do. Samyutta Nikaya 1263. Thus, the inherent stress of becoming lies not only in the instability of the factors in which it depends, but also in the stress and pain involved in those factors. Pain felt not only for the person creating those states of becoming, but also by any being providing nourishment for the person's physical existence. Viewed in this way, the two-field analogies show why becoming offers no lasting happiness and why the happiness is rarely blameless. This means that becoming, when looked at objectively, is not a desirable process in which to be engaged. Because these analogies also suggest why renewed becoming is potentially an infinitely renewable process, they show why anyone looking for true happiness would want to search for a way to bring becoming to an end.
Any questions, comments?
There is I may be misquoting or misunderstanding. There was something you said about practice, the importance of taking on, let's say, on a new practice or ascetic practice. That good practice is sustainable practice. I'm not sure if that's something along those lines, but one of the things I noticed in my own experience with being inspired, let's say, I'll take on a practice, or let's say, restrain myself in these ways, and then you do it for some amount of time, and then something just derails you, and you get demoralized, frustrated. You don't just go kind of back center, you go back swinging back the other way. And I was wondering if you just can provide some guidance just around this process of constantly like doing this.
Well, I think just to recognize that there's that tendency to swing back and forth. And part of it is, I think, a lot of it's around the approach to practice, or what we think we should be doing in practice, in the sense of, oftentimes what we think what we should do is we should be successful in our practice, or we should do it right. And I think what's more important is actually, do we learn anything whether we succeed or fail? Do we learn anything if it's easy or if it's difficult? Do we learn anything whether we like it or we dislike it? That's the much more important aspect of it. And when we start to realize that when we talk about practice, and particularly around, realize that the word that the Buddha most commonly used is sikha, like in the sila, samadhi, anya, are sikha. The dry sikha is the Noble Eightfold Path, the three trainings. But sikha also means to study or to learn. So I think our bias or our habit is that, you know, if I could just be successful at this, then I'd get something. And I'd get ahead on this. But, you know, what's more important is to understand, what am I learning? What am I, in this case, what am I becoming? What's the becoming energy behind it? Or what's it flowing out to? What's the mind flowing out to? Because if it flows out to gratification, or a sense of being something, or not being something, having a view about it, this is right, this is wrong, and so that we stake our, we put a stake in and we invest in a certain position. And of course, any position that we take is uncertain. And it's always going to be being undermined or changing or shifting in some way, shape, or form. So it's more in terms of our practice holding in a way of, what am I learning? And what can I learn from this? Because the reality is whatever practice we take on, we'll be either we're motivated or inspired by it in a certain way, and pump us up for a bit, but then we'll get bored of it, or we'll find it difficult and be frustrated by it. Or any number of scenarios, because that's its nature. But behind that changing experience is the opportunity to learn. How am I creating dukkha? How can I be free of dukkha within a circumstance? Because then you can be. So feeling like you're falling apart and practice isn't going well. But what am I learning from it? If we pick it up as a position that reflects one's sense of self, and say, I'm failing, or I'm not good enough. But that's an I position. So that's a position of suffering. But then even if you're successful, man, I got this nail. It's still a self-position. And there's something inherent within that. So it's more the approaching practice as part of the seek. This is a training, a learning, a study, opportunity to understand.
This sounds a lot like your encouragements, and I remember saying something very similar with respect to sila. In other words, not just seeing sila as, you know, like you're trying to like mold yourself into this kind of creature who behaves in these rules, but actually using the rules, the training to reflect on the mind when it's going out to and
absolutely.
Not, I see.
Yeah, very much so. But then you sort of realize, oh, it's actually the whole package that the Buddha is giving us is helpful for you.
I see. So all these, any practice we can do, we really should be looking at kind of our primary thing should be around what are we learning from this, and not about I want to become, you know, and
for
all the things that come out.
I want to be the most mindful person on the planet. Because there's people that are far more focused than we'll ever become. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they're free from suffering. So it's like learning to use that cultivation of seed of precept, sort of mindfulness of meditation. You say the wisdom is not just a piece of knowledge to remember, to hold on to as a position, but it's a perspective that allows us to discern what's beneficial, what's not beneficial, what's for our long-term well-being and happiness.
Would you be willing to speak on skillful and unskillful ways of approaching restraint?
Sure. In the sense of I think Jeff mentioned it in there that if you're just trying to hold it all in so that nothing leaks out to what's unskillful and what's bad. Because there's one, without investigating, so you realize, well, actually, just that perception of, I've got to, what kind of person has to hold himself in so tightly? It's like there's a self-perception that is this kind of raging fiend that is going to go out and do all these awful things. But then you hold it in, but then you can only hold it together so far, and fortunately or unfortunately, we don't have the opportunity to find ourselves in front of a refrigerator sparking a gallon of ice cream, and we'll do something similar, kind of just hopefully. But we can't hold it in anymore. So that's unskillful. And obviously we have to be, and that's one of the benefits of having a really clear boundaries of our precepts. Because as deranged as we can become, we don't get up to anything that creates really bad karma and has really long-term unwholesome effects on us. So that sense of restraint is you can actually take delight in it. And then also learning how to realizing that, there is a certain amount of restraint that's required just by living our life, doing our practice. I can remember in the early years of being a monk, the Buddha was really diabolical. He pulled you in and inspired you, and there's no escape. But you actually have to learn how to have fairly innocent escape, just like that. Sajjan Jeff mentioned, you're really delighting in nature, really delighting in goodness, delighting in things that are of a natural beauty, delighting in the wholesomeness and wisdom of others. And you realize there are these beings who are in very pure hearted ways. And that's something to really delight in, to focus on, direct attention to them. Or the external beauty, or doing something that is a benefit to others. If you remember at Wat Chana, feeling that having the restraint, but feeling really oppressed by it. And meditating was going so well, and so the internal, so just pick up the broom and sweeping the tiles, and just there's a creating there's a real satisfaction looking back and seeing a nicely swept path through the forest. So that, and there's just so many things that one can do that are beneficial for everybody. I'm sure you realize that walking down a nicely swept path in the forest, everybody delights in it, I'm sure. So there's putting one's energy out in things. So that's skillful use of restraint. That's where one's restraining one's actions. But doing things that are wholesome and skillful. So there's these different areas. What we're doing is learning how to direct our energy and attention in ways that are beneficial and useful.
Remember when you're talking about that meeting, this is the point of sort of recognizing that being here is just restraint. We kind of miss that, and kind of miss the joy of that. But Paul Breiter, when he was visiting kind of in the early days, and we were reading a lot about Ajahn Chah and how it was in the early days, and I was like, he was talking about you writing a book or something. And I was like, it seems really cushy here compared to what it was when you were training. He's like, are you joking? This cushy? So, and they started listing all these points, things that we don't do, just right. That he does at home. Oh, yeah.
So
also find, too, with restraint that, whenever, say I do transgress like an adhikan or something like that, and it gives me an opportunity to more vividly reflect upon the danger. And as Jeff was saying, it's, at first, of course, we're going to be in our straitjacket and we're going to be, conforming to some ideal, but if you skillfully, we start to see and actually understand the dangers. And then if you really see the dangers in investing outside, you don't need a straitjacket. You naturally recoil in the hiryotapa of, and so I find that, again, learning, specifically learning about the gravitation danger and escape.
There are two other topics of restraint that I consider using. And what I really liked about this one in particular was the karma aspect.
Right.
And that's also part of the reason with the becoming, is the fact that it really, not only you're dealing with past karma, so you have to have compassion for those things. And unfortunately, one of the other ones I think had a good simile of you're providing restraint because it's like putting a dam in the water. So it's something to see the resistance. So it's something to observe the nature of the mind, to move out. So that's why restraint is beneficial. But I went with this one because really the kind of feedback, and when you're trying to practice restraint, the benefit you see to your practice and how the continuity, and that's really why I chose this, because it really, to me, I mean, that's it. I mean, with restraint, continuity of the practice, working all the time.
Yeah, it's because sometimes, especially as we become more comfortable with that restraint, I also understand that then you realize, even without sort of a lot of struggle, practice is happening all the time. It becomes really natural.
And a question I have about that, what Sun's verse discourse, is they can see how like food is a nutriment and the intellectual intention is a nutriment. But I've always kind of wondered like how to interpret contact as a nutriment and vinyana.
Well, I mean, contact is the we don't exist in a vacuum, and we're looking for. I mean, it's interesting because to understand contact, what the Buddha points to in terms of what one understands to understand contact is understanding feeling, so understanding pleasant, painful, neutral. So that we seek what is pleasant, we run away from what's unpleasant, we get bored or confused by what's neutral. So we're constantly looking for some kind of contact to reaffirm that we exist, to reaffirm that we're something. The world is tangible that we live in. We're tangible, so that we're rely on that contact to clarify being. So contact is a major piece of that. That's what you mean. It's like when we're have a good stretch of even where things are quite steady or neutral, even. After all, you draw to even to something that's unpleasant just because it's contact, it's stimulating. And then with consciousness, that understanding of name and form, subject object, the basis of being, basis of being and becoming, so that forming of a thing, we're constantly seeking the base of those basis of becoming and being. So is being fed through consciousness. Yeah, that particular discourse to me is like one of the Buddha's lines of ours.
Another sutta, the Honeymoth Sutta?
Yeah.
Where he kind of goes through the whole progression to it. But then it goes from feeling to sanya. Is it Mahansha,
right.
Sanya Sankara?
Yeah, Sanya Sankara is a whole law word.
Yeah. I was wondering in that sutta that he starts off with the eye, the object, and the contact. And basically, it's like he goes through that. He says, if those aren't there, then it doesn't go to Mahansha. So is that like just another way of saying restraint? So like if the eyes don't see the form, or if you're not seeing the form?
Well, I mean, I mean, that's part of it, but I mean, it's not really in a sense. I mean, if there's external restraint, that's one thing, But then there has to be an internal understanding of the process. Because we can restrain externally, but we'll proliferate like crazy internally.
I've wondered about that very question, and I've read both Bhikkhu Bodhi and Ajahn Jeff's translation of that sutta, and I don't know Pali well enough, but it seems from reading those two that Bhikkhu Bodhi may have simplified the grammar in a way that perhaps obscures some of the meaning. The Pali grammar is not just, you know, when there is no I. It's something like, you know, when no I is delineated. And I probably missed, you know, but that's what Ajahn Jeff translates it. And that could have a much broader range of meanings that, you know, could allow for, the end of suffering without blindness.
I suggest Concept in Reality, but Vikanyananda. It's a whole book on
it's that, a whole book just
on that one book. That one line. And that's it's all about between that one book. That's his summary.
Okay.